Welcome to Two Wings to God. I'm your host, Rob Agnelli. Pope Benedict XVI once said that one of the greatest dangers confronting the West is what he called the self-destruction of conscience. He said not from the destruction of conscience, but the self-destruction of conscience. In other words, we've created an environment in which conscience has become paralyzed, not necessarily from a lack of use, but from abuse that stems from a profound misunderstanding of what conscience actually is. Stay tuned to today's episode, where the true meaning of conscience will be discussed.
Let me hear your words above all other voices, above all the distractions in this world.
Thanks in no smart to Walt Disney, conscience is very often seen as a thing, something like the proverbial angel on one's shoulder or the cricket who guided Pinocchio. Conscience is not, however, a thing, but an act. Specifically, it's a judgment of our reason. Conscience is not like any judgment, like something like whether ice cream is a better comfort food than pizza, but a moral judgment about what one ought to do in a given situation. The Catechism in paragraph 1777 says that conscience is a judgment of reason whereby the human person recognizes the moral quality of a concrete act that he is going to perform, is in the process of performing, or has already completed. End quote. So rather than being something outside of us, conscience is, as Vatican II defines it, the most secret core and sanctuary of a man. Now, this childish notion of conscience also leads to moral immaturity, usually in one of two forms. On the one hand are what I would like to call the Catholics who are rebellious teenagers. They are the ones who must assert their freedom by embracing the so-called primacy of conscience. Then, there are those who act like obedient children, who must submit to authority and be told what to do all the time. Even though these two seem to be opposed, they really are two sides of the same coin. Both assume that either freedom or authority must be sacrificed. The obedient children reject freedom in favor of authority, while the rebels reject authority in favor of freedom. One of the best examples that shows the mindset of the rebellious teenager occurred in an op-ed piece that I found in the Raleigh NNO in 2012. In it, the author said, quote, "One of the best kept secrets in the Catholic Church is that, like the general public, we Catholics can choose whether to follow our leadership on these issues." Specifically, she was speaking about the issues of same-sex marriage. The Church's own teaching, bound in the Catechism, states that, quote, "We are obliged to follow faithfully what we know to be just and right. A human being must always obey the certain judgment of his or her conscience." Vatican II, the U.S. bishops, and Pope John Paul II, among others, have echoed this, quote-unquote, primacy of conscience. Now, the author here assumes that in order to be free to follow one's conscience, one must discover what she calls one of the best kept secrets in the Catholic Church, that we Catholics can choose whether to follow our leadership. In other words, it is assumed that the Church has authoritatively stated that one need not listen to her authoritative statements. Now, despite this obvious contradiction, it does contain a kernel of truth that's worth looking into. First, a word about this phrase, primacy of conscience. One would be hard-pressed to find a single mention of this phrase in any magisterial document. Those who refer to it often cite that same passage that the author did from the Catechism, namely that, quote, "a human being must always obey the certain judgment of his conscience." While this does put a certain amount of emphasis on the necessity of following one's conscience, there's a key modifier in that sentence that cannot be overlooked. Advocates of the primacy of conscience consistently omit this modifier, the word "certain." The Catechism says that we must obey a certain conscience. Now, according to the late Father John Horton in his Modern Catholic Dictionary, a certain conscience is, quote, "a state of mind when it has no prudent fear of being wrong about its judgment on some moral issue and firmly decides that some action is right or wrong," end quote. In other words, a certain conscience has two components. It's a judgment based upon sound reasoning and deliberation, and second, it refers to the moral law. It's not a mere moral opinion based on a superficial assessment of a situation, nor is it looking for reasons to justify what they want. We call that rationalizing. Instead, it is both sound and principled reasoning. Those who appeal to the primacy of conscience never refer to whether they are right or not. All that matters to them is whether or not the person acted in accord with their conscience. In this understanding of conscience, conscience itself trumps truth. The subjective definition of conscience is so embedded in our language that we even refer to someone like St. Thomas More as a martyr for conscience, as if he merely made up his mind that the church was right and Henry VIII was wrong and simply stuck to his guns. But St. Thomas More died as a martyr for the truth. And like all martyrs, he was a witness to the truth. He was no more a martyr of conscience than any martyr is. And herein lies the problem for those who hold this mistaken idea of the primacy of conscience. By their logic, you could take someone like St. Thomas More on one hand and Adolf Eichmann on the other, who said during the Nuremberg trials that he was only being true to his conscience. Are they willing to say that both of these men were equally laudable? The rebel, though, is not the only morally immature Catholic. There is also the danger of swinging in the opposite, although equally wrong, direction. Very often, so-called traditional Catholics will speak of the need for all Catholics to obey the magisterium. Again, there is truth here, but it's only to a certain point. The problem with this view is that the conscience becomes something like a moral GPS, and man goes and occasionally downloads maps from the magisterium, and it ultimately is led to a place he really doesn't want to go. And like the rebel, these obedient children see the dictates of conscience as something external to man, who must force his will to conform to that of moral authority, rather than to truth itself. And so despite the conventional wisdom of popular culture, obedience is still a virtue. But like all virtues, it must be rooted in charity in order to be a true virtue. Constant appeals to authority in matters of morality eventually stunt our ability to develop our conscience freely. We have to rely on our superiors to tell us what to do, and it leaves us in this suspended state of moral immaturity. Therefore, being an obedient child is the surest path to legalism that Jesus condemned in the Pharisees. It leads to something like a moral minimalism, which simply just asks, how far can I go until this is considered sinful? This is not the language of a man who is free to love, but of one who feels himself bound by legal constraints. Our Lord came so that we might be free, because only in freedom is love made possible. Obedience itself doesn't lead to love. Instead, love includes obedience. Thankfully, there's an alternative to these two positions, one that helps us grow out of the obedient child or rebellious teenager roles in which we have been stuck and enables us to grow to full moral maturity. Within the Catechism definition of conscience, we find a blueprint for the bridge between freedom and authority. Recall the definition the Catechism gives. Conscience is a judgment of reason whereby the human person recognizes the moral quality of a concrete act. So by what standard does one determine this so-called moral quality of a concrete act? But before we can answer that question, I think we must first clarify what we mean when we speak of morality. Morality, simply put, is the relationship between a human act, one that's done with knowledge and freedom, and the use of man's nature in fulfilling his final end, namely to become a saint, to have communion with God in heaven. Some acts are in accord with the proper use of man's nature and lead us to thrive. We call these good. And some are not and cause us to become slaves. We call these bad or sinful. Because human nature and its fulfillment are objective, certain goods are common to all men. Reason recognizes these goods as true goods and commands that they be protected, preserved, and promoted. These commandments of reason are what comprise the moral law. So therefore, when we speak of the moral quality of a concrete act, it can be determined by how it measures up to the moral law. The moral law then serves as this bridge between freedom and authority. It still remains, though, for us to talk about where this moral law comes from. The rebellious teenager says that the moral truth comes from within the individual. The obedient toddler says that the moral law is imposed on us from the outside. But which one is right? The word for conscience in Latin is conscientia, and this gives us a clue. Translated, it literally means knowledge with. Conscience is literally the co-knowledge that man shares with God. This shared knowledge about reality shows why conscience has authority. God governs all of creation by his divine providence. And because God always acts in accord with reason, we say that all things participate in this eternal law of God's reason. Each creature is made with natural inclinations towards those things which will fulfill its ultimate purpose or end. Only man, though, because he has an intellect and a will, can know and choose to participate in this eternal law. And we call man's participation in the eternal law of God, at least according to St. Thomas Aquinas, the natural law. Therefore, the natural law comes from within only insofar as it is mediated by God through our reason. We look at human nature and we can determine what is truly good for us, what are true goods, and we are naturally inclined towards those things. But because it's a participation in the divine law, it has a source itself outside of man, that is, God himself. And it is in light of this understanding that St. Paul says to the Gentiles who, quote, who have not the law, as, quote, a law unto themselves, because they do by nature what the law requires. See Romans 2:12. There's no contradiction here between either the freedom or the objective moral law. Freedom comes only insofar as we do those things which reason discovers are truly good for us. So, the moral law comes to us through our intellect, but of course, we're not taking into account that we're fallen creatures, and we had this innate, we had this seeming knowledge of good and evil. So although our innate desire for the good cannot be extinguished, the darkening of the intellect that accompanied the fall causes us great difficulty in discovering what's really truly good. Our reason, in the words of Pope Benedict XVI, must now be, quote, suffused with the light of God's truth. In fact, when human reason humbly allows itself to be purified by faith, it is far from weakened. Rather, it is strengthened to resist presumption and to reach beyond its own limitations. End quote. The light of God's truth flows through the church. The church informs conscience in much the same way that the soul informs the body, giving it life and making it what it is. St. Thomas teaches that we need revelation in the practical order for two reasons. The first is that since we're fallen creatures, and without revelation, the truth would be, quote, would be known only by a few, and after a long time, and with the mixture of many errors. Second, because man has a supernatural end, that is, not just to become virtuous, but to become holy, there are certain truths that surpass human reason. For example, how do we know we have to be baptized? That has to be revealed to us. And it's not something we can necessarily discover by reason. Why are we drawn to marriage? We can discover that by reason because it leads to our fulfillment. And so these two things, certainly we need revelation on the one hand and we need human reason on the other. The church, as described in John Paul II's Veritati Splendor, is, quote, at the service of conscience, helping it to avoid being tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine proposed by human deceit, and helping it not to swerve from the truth about the good of man, but rather, especially in most difficult questions, to attain the truth with certainty and to abide in it. That's number 64 from Veritati Splendor. The church does not impose the truths of man's proper use of his nature from the outside, but instead proposes those truths to man's reason, so that he may recognize them as true goods, true internal values, and accept them as his own. Conscience indeed is primary, but only a conscience that is animated by a desire to become what we are made to be, to become saints. For this and more on all aspects of our divine faith, navigate over to www.twowingstogod.com. That's www.twowingstogod.com. Everything else will fade away, but